Welcome to the Nation of Writers podcast, presented in conjunction with our exhibit American Voices, which you can explore in person or online at nationofwriters.org. In this episode, we discuss the life and legacy of Gertrude Stein. A poet, novelist, and essayist, Stein was a towering literary figure in her time. She moved to Paris in 1902 with her partner, Alice B. Toklas, where they would spend the remainder of their lives. Together, they held regular salons in their apartment that became the stuff of legend, hosting the likes of Ernest Hemingway, F. Scott and Zelda Fitzgerald, Pablo Picasso, and more. Stein's fame as a mentor to other writers often obscures her own accomplishments. Her writing was experimental, both in language and in form. She achieved international celebrity in 1933 with the autobiography of Alice B. Toklas, written in the voice of her devoted partner. Other significant works include the 900-page avant-garde epic, The Making of Americans, the experimental prose poem, Tender Buttons, and countless essays and letters that further illuminate her desire to reimagine what literature can do. For this episode, we are joined by a biographer, Francesca Wade, author of the new book, Gertrude Stein, An Afterlife. Pushing beyond the conventions of literary biography, Wade uncovers the origins of Stein's radical style and highlights the storied relationship that made it possible. You can learn more about Wade's work in the episode description. Francesca is interviewed by Nate King, content and exhibits manager at the American Writers Museum. This conversation originally took place September 19th, 2025, and was recorded over Zoom.
Well, Francesca, thank you for joining me today on this episode of Nation of Writers. I'm excited to talk about Gertrude Stein with you and learn a little bit more about both the legend of Gertrude Stein and then also, like your book, the afterlife also, and how how legacies are made is a very fascinating aspect of your book. So I'm excited to get to talk to you about it. Before we get into that, could you introduce yourself for our listeners and tell us a little bit about how you first encountered Stein's work and the biography?
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here. I guess the Stein is my second book. My first book was called Square Haunting, and it's a kind of group biography of five women writers who all lived in the same Bloomsbury Square in London during the wars. So I was already very interested in women's lives and in kind of modernist kind of early 20th century literary history. And Stein, of course, although didn't spend much time in London, was very much a kind of looming shadow over that and sort of intersected in interesting ways with some of the women that I had been researching before. Virginia Woolf, for example, who didn't like Stein much and rejected her epic novel, The Making of Americans, for the Hogarth Press because she couldn't get through it. And Hilda Doolittle, HD, another of my previous subjects, who kind of overlapped in Paris as kind of lesbian circles with her partner, Briar, who was quite friendly with Stein. So I guess it was sort of after I'd finished writing Square Haunting, I picked up Janet Malcolm's 2007 book, Two Lives, which is has sort of a combination of two long New Yorker essays about Stein and Toklas and their kind of legacies, one mostly kind of probing their wartime experiences and the other telling the story of a PhD student, Leon Katz, who had gone to Stein's archive in the early 50s, shortly after her death, and had stumbled upon a tranche of notebooks, which seemed almost like a diary of Stein's early years in Paris. And he had then had a kind of unprecedented opportunity to interview Alice B. Toklas, who was very wary of biographers and didn't give many people this access. And he'd then spent the rest of his life working on a book which was going to draw on these interviews, but he never actually published it. And Malcolm is interested in the, sort of what happens to a field of scholarship when someone is sort of proprietary over material. And so her kind of investigation, I guess, moved somewhat away from Stein. But I was just so fascinated to find out what had happened next and had he ever published this book. And it turned out that he died in 2017 and his papers were now at the Beinecke Library, where Stein's archive, enormous archive, is. And so that was really the start of this project, starting from just sort of wanting to know what Toklas had said over these months. And then it broadened out further and further because Stein is such a beguiling subject that I soon realized I wanted to know everything about her.
Yeah, I feel like beguiling is the the operative word for Stein. And that the story with cats is also a fascinating aspect of, like I said, the how a legacy is crafted. And Alice B. Toklas was a stalwart in championing Stein's work, but then also, like you said, weary of how that legacy is continued. So, and also in reading your book, you were one of the first people, if not the first person, to look at Katz's notes, right? What was that like? You mentioned it a little bit just now, like, yeah.
Well, it was very exciting because, Stein is such a storied figure, and, there's been so much, her image has been pulled apart so much, her legend is so kind of well known and notorious. But I suspected that, it's somewhat of a caricature, and there are some sort of very kind of well-trodden anecdotes, little snippets of quotes from Stein that are, that are almost cliched. Rose is a rose is a rose, and there is no there, which everyone knows. But there's just so much more of her writing that is so little read, really. And I was sure that, the kind of popular image of her personality, and of her relationship with Toklas, wasn't in any way the full story. And so, but I guess, because she seems so kind of monolithic, it's hard to know quite where to kind of approach her from. And so the prospect of having this kind of fresh material was what made me think that it might be something, a kind of way to delve in not only to Stein's life, but also to this question that had started to really interest me of how legends form, like, these the sort of myth of, Golden Age Paris of the 20s, which Stein is so central to, I think, perhaps especially in the American imagination, the idea of sort of Americans abroad, Hemingway and Fitzgerald, rattling around Paris showing their manuscripts to the sort of sage kind of cult leader, Gertrude Stein. And so, yeah, the chance to hear from Toklas was, I guess, what really drew me to the story of Katz's research, because Toklas is such a kind of shadowy figure in the Stein mythology. I mean, Stein became so famous in 1933 for her autobiography, The Autobiography of Alice B. Toklas, which is really the story of Stein, but put in her partner's voice, very artfully. And it's this kind of subterfuge of memoir where it's ostensibly written by Toklas, but actually we don't learn much about Toklas at all because she can only talk about Gertrude Stein. So the chance to sort of authentically hear from her, and especially from her at this later point in her life when Stein had died about 6 years before, and she was now renegotiating her own sense of identity and her relationship to Stein now as a memory, and as a sort of myth that she herself now kind of had the chance to take forward. It was really fascinating.
Yeah, I imagine so. And a lot of points I want to jump off from here, but maybe now's a good time to kind of give our listeners a sort of brief overview. I mean, you wrote a whole book about her life, but maybe a brief overview of kind of times and places where Stein lived. And because he, like Paris, you mentioned, and that's, I think, location is a big part of Stein's inspiration as well. So maybe just a little brief overview of Stein's life
Yeah, of course.
yeah.
Yeah, well, she was born in 1874 in Pennsylvania. She moved around a bit as a child, had a little stint in Europe, and sort of settled with her family in Oakland, which is where she kind of mainly grew up. Her parents died when she was a teenager, first her mother and then her father, and she her older brother Michael, was a very kind of inspired businessman and invested the kind of inheritance from their parents in the San Francisco cable car kind of industry, which was booming. And he sort of set things up so well that his siblings had a sort of modest but useful income for life. And Stein and her other brother Leo moved off to Harvard. Leo was at Harvard, and Stein was among the first women students at what became Radcliffe, at that point was the Harvard Annex. And she studied psychology with William James, who encouraged her to kind of pursue her scientific studies. And she went on to Johns Hopkins in Baltimore as one of the first women in its medical school. So in her sort of 20s, Stein was spending her time in pretty serious kind of neurological investigations into the ways that the mind works, the way the mind processes language and pays attention. She did some really interesting experiments, which are in her first kind of published writing, which were to do with kind of ascertaining how, whether it's possible to pay attention to two things at once, to take something in through the ears while also, you know, writing something sort of with a different part of the mind. She then, yeah, really did some quite intense kind of mapping out of the brain. So she had this, you know, pretty robust kind of psychological background, which I think then she moved to Paris, where Leo had already moved, and they were extremely close. And she was sort of recovering from a difficult breakup with a complicated kind of love triangle with two other women she had been involved with in Baltimore. More. So moving to Paris in 1903, when she was, I think, 29, was a big kind of break with the past in lots of sort of different ways, leaving America, leaving her family, leaving this relationship. And that's when she and Leo, with their kind of windfall inheritance, started to buy paintings to really for fun and to decorate their apartment. And they were among the first to kind of appreciate Matisse and Picasso, who became very close with Stein. And he was kind of on the verge at this point of kind of breaking into cubism. And Stein herself was starting to write, and was kind of thinking about new ways of using language, I think drawing very much on her scientific studies and the influence of the sort of distortions and new forms she was seeing in the art that was being made in Paris around her. And so that's when she, as she describes, sitting for Picasso to paint her portrait, and this moment becomes so kind of emblematic for her for the rest of her life, because she says that it was painting her portrait that made Picasso sort of break out into cubism. And while she was sitting for it, she was writing in her mind the sentences which she said would be the first step out of the 19th century and into the 20th in literature. So that sort of the friendship with Picasso and the sort of comparison of what they were doing in art and in writing was very important to her sense of what she was doing.
That is fascinating. And yeah, just looking back on it now, what a moment, right? The two of them in a room for a while. Yeah.
Yeah, you want to be a fly on the wall.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. And that leads me to another sort of the and you also mentioned it, the kind of nostalgia of that era of the modernists in Paris, you know. I think in your book you also mentioned the film Midnight in Paris, and so like there is a like cultural interest in that, you know, 100 years later. And but then it also makes me think of the how much of that image did Stein craft herself, as that we're looking back on it now, but like as she was doing it, you know, another you might know the quote better, but she's mentions writing about for an audience 50 years later, right? Or, you know, so yeah.
Yeah, I think this is one of the things I found so fascinating about Stein, was her kind of sense of her own posterity and her sort of projection of herself into a future in which she would be sort of historical. Right at the end of her life, she was invited to write a preface for a one for a compendium of her selected works, which was a dream she'd had for a long time. And in the preface, she said, "I always wanted to be historical, almost from a baby on," which is a sort of amazing thing to say. But Stein always had this self-confidence and belief that what she was doing was important, which really sustained her and needed to sustain her, because in her time, her writing was greeted with some of the most hostile reception that is possible to imagine. And yeah, this question of the legend, Stein really did kind of set it up herself. I mean, once she had moved to Paris, she started writing in these very kind of new styles. She started kind of exploring the kind of way that words sound and look on the page, rather than trying to put them together in a, you know, conventional sentence. She wasn't interested in sense. She was interested in a kind of experiential, sort of immersive reading experience that would sort of attune the reader to the very present moment she was writing in by these kind of cascades of repeated sentences and words and phrases, and kind of with these slight variations that she wanted to sort of carry the reader along on the current with. And she moved away from that style relatively quickly, although it's become such a sort of hallmark of the way people think about her. She was always experimenting. And always, once she felt she'd gone as far as she could with an idea, she'd do something else and try and sort of stretch words out in different ways, use them. I think her aim was always to use words in ways they'd never been used before, to surprise and confound and make readers feel new things and experience new sensations, I think was her aim. But when this proved too confounding for publishers and critics, I mean, she actually was became very famous for this style, although most of the reviewers of her books kind of admitted they hadn't read them, but they liked to parody them often very inaccurately. And so, yeah, she became quite notorious. But what she really wanted was to be read and taken seriously. And so in 1933, she decided to write an autobiography, which really, I think, her ulterior motive was wanting to almost write an extended advertisement for her previous work and make the case for its importance. But really what it ended up doing was whetting appetites for more, gossip and revelations about Bohemian Paris. Another ulterior motive was a lot of score settling. Stein did like to make enemies and held grudges. So it's full of pretty devastating takedowns and one-liners, and notable for who it leaves out. But Stein had, yeah, was sure that the early work had its value and that that would come to be appreciated. And in 1926, so quite a while before the autobiography, she'd given a lecture where she talked about how truly radical work will never be appreciated in its own time. But 50 years later, people will come to see it as beautiful when in the moment it looks ugly. And I think she was very much thinking of Picasso at that point, whose work had shocked people when it was first shown, but actually quite quickly had, come to seem accepted. And she felt that that would be the case for her writing too. And I suppose the huge success of the autobiography was a sort of bittersweet experience because she achieved this fame that she always felt she deserved. But it wasn't for the style of writing that she felt was her true innovation. And that's, I think, the point at which she starts to look to posthumous reception and put her hopes on a future that she couldn't even envisage.
The different ways she uses language makes me it made me think of a in the prologue you wrote, Stein is less a writer in the conventional sense than a philosopher of language. Words were both her medium and her subject. And so I'm wondering if you could expand on that a little bit. And because you've already mentioned it, she was interested in thinking about how words and the brain react, with her back, her scientific background. So yeah, the philosopher of language part caught my eye. So I'm curious if you could just expand on that.
I think Stein looked at words, almost as kind of physical entities, almost like paint. I think she saw them for their shapes and their colors. She saw, I think she saw meaning, not as something that she that had to be kind of pursued in a literary sense, but she was interested in the kind of accumulations that words sort of accrue over their use and whether it's possible to almost take them out of the context, which she saw as having become stale. And she didn't want a word, when she said it, to remind you of every other time that you've heard that word. She wanted you to see it for what it is in that moment, and unique to its position in this Steinian sentence, and to kind of, to conjure up perhaps alternative associations based not on its position in the sort of structures of of grammar and the history of the English language, but in something specific to where it was with her. So she often uses sort of puns. There's often kind of associations which only she could really unfold. There's this scholar, Ulla Dido, who spent years studying Stein's manuscripts and noticed how often Stein's texts took their cues from the sort of illustrations on the front of her notebooks, for example, or from sort of shopping lists and lists of visitors, that she is always kind of taking in her surroundings and what was and her mood and sort of what was going on, and trying to create, I guess, a text that wouldn't texts that don't have narratives or characters or plots, but convey a sense of experience, something more sort of perceptual. And that's where I think her scientific background is so important, because I think she was really fascinated by this experience of kind of perception and the, what goes on inside our heads when we speak or read or encounter the world or look at a painting or a flower or something. And I think, one of the paradoxes of Stein, I think, is that in a way her writing is the product of this very internal, personal, solitary, concentrated, almost meditative process. And that's one of the reasons I love reading her work so much, because it feels like you're almost in her head as things are sort of whirring, and as she's working out, stretching out words, putting them next to other ones, creating, building something new until she, really reaches what she wants to say. But that can also, of course, be a very frustrating process, because for readers who aren't sort of attuned to that style, and she didn't like to explain her work or give readers sort of tools and ways into it. Yeah, it can be quite kind of formidable. So it was so private, and yet she so wanted readers. And I think that's was the sort of tension that really got to her and frustrated her, especially when she saw some of her contemporaries, like Joyce, for example, who were also stretching at language in different ways, but who seemed to be taken seriously, and whose strange writing seemed worthy of interrogation, whereas hers tended to be dismissed or seen as a sign of sort of insanity or eccentricity.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, because me personally, I find both of Joyce and Stein to be formidable and a bit frustrating, but I have more fun reading Stein.
It is fun. I think
Yeah.
I what really kind of clicked for me, I think, was starting to read her work aloud, because I think that's where a lot of the kind of humor of the oddness and the juxtapositions kind of come out. And actually, I can find it quite kind of calming to listen to it, and and sort of, yeah, let the ideas and the images kind of build organically. Sometimes looking at it on a page, it's harder to kind of take it all in, because her work is so kind of sensual, and so much it sort of depends on the rhythms and the sounds, I think. And I think I also just found it liberating to know that it's not meant to make sense. I mean, Stein was always insistent on that, sense and narrative and creating a likeness are not what she's about. And she said, if you enjoy it, you understand it, which wasn't too helpful for people who felt they didn't enjoy it. But I think, it does, that was meaningful to her, the idea that she was not wanting to, offer a message for people to take in and understand. She wanted to create a sensation in her readers, and I like that the sensation she kind of named as enjoyment. I think that sort of sums up her philosophy of life as well.
And that makes me think, in your research, how did other people describe her in person, that in her kind of personality, in hosting the salon regularly? There's a lot of brilliant artists and writers coming through and visiting her in Alice. And but what was she like in person? Could you describe her, the person that Gertrude Stein is was?
Yeah, well, I think, I mean, yeah, she it's she's so many people left their impressions of her, from close friends to people who only visited once and swore never to go back. And Yeah, generally there's a certain amount of bafflement. I think she was very performative and sort of played this role in the salon. I mean, she and her brother had been collecting art since they had arrived in Paris, and quite quickly their home had sort of word had spread that there was this house, this apartment that was almost like a museum of modern art, and they had this policy where anyone could come in on a Saturday night to look at the art, and they didn't sort of lay on a spread or anything kind of glamorous. I think they really just opened the door and would talk to people, and so quite quickly, coming to see the Steins became, almost like a thing to do. Particularly after the First World War, I think when there was a real influx of American writers in Paris, the generation, which Stein, in fact, was the one who labeled it the lost generation of Hemingway and Fitzgerald and people like Paul Bowles and various musicians as well, like Virgil Thompson. And I think to this kind of younger generation of mostly kind of young men, Stein was a sort of heroic figure, and they treated her, almost like a kind of cult leader. And she played up to that. And having faced so much kind of opposition for her writing, she latched on, I think, to people who praised her and worshipped her. And yet, if people went too far, she didn't like that either. And there are lots of stories of her cutting friends off, without any explanation. And Toklas was often the one to slam the door or deliver the phone call. So I think, yeah, people's impressions of her are often characterized by sort of bewilderment, slight fear, slight uncertainty of what she was going to be like. But people, speak about her sort of brilliance and her, I think, clearly kind of listening to her talk would be a quite astonishing and unlikely experience. But I get the sense that she t got quite tired of playing up to this kind of public eccentric image, which very much kind of sustained the sort of mythology that she, was putting around in the service of trying to get readers for her work. But I think particularly after they did a 7-month lecture tour of America after the autobiography was so successful, and Stein went round giving lectures and talking to people, and I think she loved the attention and the celebrity, but also found it rather disquieting because of that paradox we were talking about, that really her writing process demanded this absolutely solitary concentration, and I think she felt that fame kind of took her outside of herself so much that she found it difficult to return to that kind of unselfconscious state of being able to take in her impressions of the world and put it into words. She felt too sort of mediated, I guess, by the press and by other people's opinions. So I think the sort of last decade or so of her life was a bit of a kind of struggle between those forces of sort of public and private and sociability and solitude.
Yeah, that the double-edged sword of fame, right? It's and it's always, and you've mentioned it, she wanted that so badly, but then once you get it, it's maybe not exactly what she was thinking about. And then I'm curious, because she kind of sounds almost prophetic to me in a way of mentioning, like, towards the end of her life, focusing on what her legacy will be after her life. And then, sure enough, we're still 100 years later, we're talking about her. So yeah, because it also makes me think, at the museum, American Writers Museum, we're opening a new exhibit on November 21st called "American Prophets: Writers, Religion, and Culture." In your book, you've mentioned she visited monks regularly while in France, grew up Jewish, right? So I'm curious the role that spirituality played in her life and writing, and whether she was specifically a practitioner of a re specific religion, or kind of more had a more general spirituality. I'm curious if that came up in your research at all.
Yeah, that's so interesting. I think she did have interest in sort of spirituality, but like so much of Stein, it's quite contradictory and sort of hard to totally untangle. I mean, she grew up, she's Jewish, and I think there was a very interesting kind of scholarly book published in 2020 by Amy Feinstein, who wrote about Stein's sort of Jewish modernism. And I think there's been a bit of a assumption that Stein, almost renounced her Jewishness or wasn't interested in it. But actually, this book really shows how much she did engage with Jewishness kind of all through her writing in sort of various, complicated and interesting ways. She was, I guess, sort of drawn to Catholicism, strangely. She loved kind of Catholic saints. This opera she wrote, Four Saints in Three Acts, which played on Broadway in 1934, was sort of a sensation, drew on the lives of Saint Teresa of Avila and Saint Ignatius of Loyola. And she loved sort of Catholic iconography. I think she was drawn to the idea of saints. There's something she was, I think, fascinated by mortality and immortality, and it ties in with her idea of genius. I think she often connects saints and genius in her writings, and I think what she sort of sees them having in common is she calls it something like a future feeling, which I think is a kind of sense of the self that, transcends the body and the present moment. And I think it does link in with her own sense of an artist as creating something that will last way beyond their time and, will speak to people in ways that, that even the artist himself can't predict. I mean, yeah, I didn't go too psychoanalytical on Stein because it's difficult, but I think, she had this experience of losing her parents at a young age. I think her sort of experience of or sense of mortality was quite acute, and a couple of her friends mentioned her having a real sort of desperate sort of fear of death that can be kind of discerned, particularly in her kind of later writing, her book Wars I Have Seen, which is an almost sort of diaristic kind of account of living in France during the Second World War. And she never really mentions the fact that she was Jewish and in incredible danger, but it's kind of bubbling there beneath the surface, almost as something she didn't want to confront. I mean, Stein was good at not confronting things she didn't want to confront. But yes, I think there's definitely a sense of spirituality. Someone mentioned that or someone asked me quite recently if Stein was a Buddhist, and I don't think she ever mentioned Buddhism, but but lots of her interests do sort of chime, I think, with Buddhist philosophy, which might have come to her through William James. So yeah, there's lots of avenues to explore with that idea.
Yeah, certainly. Yeah. And just, I mean, the title of your biography is, Gertrude Stein, An Afterlife, which is, it has religious connotations as well. And so yeah, it's interesting. She's so, preoccupied with death and perhaps, would you say perhaps worried about what her literary afterlife would be? Was that part of her like fear of death?
Yeah, I think so. Because I think she, she her writing in a way is all about the sort of process of creation, and she often, said that, that writing sort of does need readers, and I think her work actually sort of more than most almost requires a kind of activation by a reader to kind of live and sort of sing. And so I think she was anxious that her work would kind of languish and fester, and a lot of it had never been published. I mean, at her death, probably only about half of her output had actually appeared. And she thought carefully about this and left instructions in her will that she wanted her literary executors to publish everything she'd ever written, every single word, and that they could sell off the art collection to fund that if they couldn't find a commercial publisher to take it on. So she'd really made provisions for that legacy. And I think that's, going back to what she said in 1926 about work needing to find readers sort of in its own time. I think she, at her death, felt, somewhat satisfied with the success of the autobiography and the publication of this selected works at the end. But I think she felt the work wasn't done. And yeah, that was really the starting point for this book, I think, taking on a subject who was so committed to the future of their work that they sort of left this problem almost for her friend Carl van Vechten, who was put in charge of the publishing program, and for Toklas, who had the sort of dual responsibility of stewarding both the work into print, but also navigating the question of how Stein as a person would be remembered. And Stein had also left an enormous archive of her personal papers, her manuscripts, but also letters and all kinds of sort of personal effects to Yale University. So Toklas had to steel herself for biographers to come and approach her and read Stein as they chose to. And so, yeah, the sort of ethical dilemmas that that led to were something I found really fascinating and to explore.
Was there anything especially in your research that you uncovered that was like really surprising to you?
I mean, there's so much. I mean, both Stein and Toklas are ever surprising. I mean, I think Toklas, in a way, is the more sort of surprising character because she had this so sort of totally kind of second life, I guess, after Stein had died, where she really had to take control. And I think, Toklas was essentially an extremely private person who was thrust into this public role by dint of being with Stein. And the ways in which she was incredibly devoted to Stein in her lifetime, almost to the point of caricature, typing up everything Stein did, keeping people away from her. And she the way she sort of expertly transformed that devotion after Stein's death into a devotion to the legacy, even when it exposed her to a kind of scrutiny that she had absolutely disavowed up to that point, I found really moving. And I guess these Leon Katz interviews, I didn't know what she would have said. And he confronted her with several things he'd found in the archive, which had the potential to be very sort of disturbing to her kind of memories of life with Stein. And he thought long and hard about whether he should show her, for example, that Stein's first impressions of her were pretty horrible. And he had a lot of questions, really. And I think the way that she came out of that encounter is this incredibly kind of steely, quite fierce character who just upheld this absolute commitment to Stein's work. And to creating the conditions for Stein to make that work, yeah, is sort of heroic in a way. It's a real kind of it's an extraordinary sort of love story that had this, that was geared around the production of this sort of extraordinary body of work, which I think we're still kind of catching up to. And that's where I wanted to kind of end the book, really, was on the way that Stein's work has been taken up by artists and poets and dancers kind of in the second half of the 20th century, and it still goes on. I think she was prescient that that people would see the possibilities in her work, even when they're working in media that didn't exist in her lifetime, or working in a context, for example, where queer sexuality could be celebrated in a way that it never was in her time. And her work has become so sort of important and iconic in kind of lesbian and feminist readings. So yeah, I think she was yeah she saw that, I think, and Toklas made it possible.
Yeah, it's like we're all trying to catch up to Gertrude Stein.
Yeah, and I think that yeah that legacy is maybe greatest in art.
You've mentioned some of the more famous Stein quotes. Is there any do you have any quotes or passages that you especially found in your research or kind of that you that might like It's kind of impossible to sum up Gertrude Stein, but is there anything that is especially telling that you mentioned some of them, but any other quotes maybe that you the very Steinian quote.
Yeah, oh, there's so many. I mean, it's hard to talk about her even as kind of one writer because her style changed so many times, and there are so many sort of different Steins. I mean, I think the period of Stein's work that I probably love the most is the sort of quite early period with the sort of transition away from the sort of repetitive style into the, I guess you could call it a kind of cubist style that led to her work Tender Buttons of 1914, which is probably where I'd suggest people start with Stein. I love also her sort of very quite sort of intense explorations of grammar that she did in the kind of 20s and early 30s. I think they lead to some of the most sort of beautiful and bizarre kind of Steinian sentences. They're sort of so enigmatic and sort of funny and intriguing. And she, I think she writes in the autobiography that, you know, people always say they don't understand her work, but she says, "My sentences do get under their skin." And that's something I really found that, you know, after while reading Stein, you know, you sort of attune to her sensibility and her way of looking at the world. And I love that. And then her later work is really fascinating too. And she develops a slightly different, a sort of a kind of chatty style, very personal, very sort of forthright. I mean, not personal as in kind of confessional, but personal as in direct and opinionated and presenting things as fact, even if they're completely sort of strange. And so, yeah, there are so many Steins, and
I loved what you ended the epilogue with, quote, "She is my wife," writes Stein. That is what a paragraph is, always at home. And I love that one because it made me, you mentioned it earlier, her like the just interrogation of language and like what is a paragraph, you know? And it's and that's one where I've read that multiple times. I've seen that line before as well, and it's again, I don't know what it means, but I like to think about it. I don't have an answer for if someone asked me, what does that mean? I wouldn't know,
No.
but I enjoy it, you know,
Yes, so you understand
so I understand it.
it.
We're getting close to the end here. We'll start wrapping up, but I liked your response in the emails we were sending earlier about that one question, you know, if Gertrude Stein were alive today, and that one, it's hard to answer for any person that is deceased, but I feel like especially for Stein. But I think some of these quips, you know, I think would play well on social media. I think for sure, where you have a short amount of space.
I think she'd be cancelled, but I think she'd be one of those people who just persists and keeps posting through it, and eventually there's nothing to do but praise her.
Was she interested in new technologies as they were coming out? Because I feel like she saw a lot in her lifetime. So, and I'm curious if in any way she like impacted her art or any or in any
So
writing.
interesting. Yeah, I think so. She, well, I don't know. She loved cars, fast cars in particular. She once kind of interestingly compares her writing to the sort of frames of a cinema, of a movie kind of moving forward. But she didn't really go to the cinema. She was, I mean, it's so Stein. She was oddly conservative and traditional in lots of ways, while also being so radical in other ways. This is one interesting episode, which I'm really endlessly intrigued by, which is that someone called Bob Brown in the 30s came up after reading Stein, came up with this idea of a, I think he called it a reading machine, where he would sort of almost like input the text of a book and it would flash before the reader's eyes at such a speed that you almost would be reading a book, almost just putting it directly into your brain rather than, you know, wasting time turning the pages and so on. And he wrote to Stein and said he was making a prototype of this machine and could she contribute a text to it? And she did, and she liked it. And I mean, the machine didn't happen, but I think she was quite tickled by the idea of someone making a technology that was designed to, I don't know, to enhance or experience or bring the reading experience almost into the mind, or sort of dissolve the boundary between the text and the sort of recipient of the text. There's been, yeah, really interesting kind of academic work done more recently, kind of reading Stein's work in relation to sort of computers and even large language models. I mean, it's, you know, The Making of Americans is this epic 1,000-page novel, which is all about the sort of technology of creating the novel and stratifying humanity. But yet Stein's work is so kind of against the possibilities of the algorithm or the prediction of text. I mean, you know how AIs are always, you know, are basing on expectations of what people, how people make sentences and how people answer questions. And Stein's work is almost trying to reprogram the brain away from convention. So I think there'd be an interesting reading of Stein as the ultimate sort of anti-AI machine reading machine.
Yeah, that's I love that. That's a great point. Yeah. They wouldn't, yeah, the robots wouldn't know what to make sense.
No, yeah, exactly. You'd think that a robot could probably claim it could write exactly like Gertrude Stein, but actually the test would be that it absolutely couldn't. And that's why, you know, that's why her writing, it's so easy to sort of dismiss it or parody it or say, yeah, you know, a rose is a rose. I know Stein, but actually, you know, she's so rewarding of deeper, kind of closer attention, which really just, I think, requires one to kind of have a curiosity and ultimately to start off by taking her seriously and to then, yeah, see what happens when you kind of open your mind to her. That's at least that's how I've sort of taught myself to read Stein, I guess. And reading her through others, you know, reading Stein, write other writing on Stein is always just so fascinating, I think, because she really kind of inspires kind of fascinating interpretations and exploration. So there's a lot of very creative Stein criticism, and of course, really creative, you know, poetry that's engaged with her work. I mean, poets like Harriet Mullen and Charles Bernstein and Lynn Hagenian, and lots of others who have taken up her work and probed it and pushed it in new directions that, yeah, that help us read Stein again. So yeah, it's a very generative world to enter, I
That's a
think.
great,
And full of, and just the life itself has just got to be one of the most kind of brilliant, colorful lives of the 20th century. Just being in that time and that place, and you know, she was always in the right place at the right time, and people she was surrounded by, and yeah, what she was doing. It's just, yeah, it's just one of those lives that you can't get enough of, I think.
That's a great way to put it. And thank you for writing the book, researching and writing the book.
It's
For our
been my
listeners,
pleasure.
it's called Gertrude Stein, An Afterlife. What do you hope readers take away from reading your book?
Well, if they enjoy it, they understand it.
There you
And I
go.
hope that it'll send readers back to Stein in a way and yeah, unpick some of the things that they think they know about her. I think people come to Stein with preconceptions, sometimes good, but often negative. And so I just hope that this book will strip away some of those or sort of probe how they have built up. And present her really as a human, you know, who's flawed and complex and confounding, but also, yeah, funny and real and just trying to devoting her life to art really and doing something exciting.
I know it, all those things came out when I read it, so I can attest.
Oh, thank you.
So the book comes out October 7th. And so do you have any upcoming events?
Yes, I'll be traveling around a bit in New York and California, Boston, Baltimore, Washington,
Nice.
Toronto. I'm excited to meet people and other Stein fans around.
Spread the word. Well, Francesca, thank you for joining me today on the Nation of Writers. I had a blast chatting with you. Was there anything we didn't cover that you wanted to touch base on?
No, I think we've covered lots. It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Nation of Writers podcast, part of the American Writers Museum Podcast Network. If you would like to learn more about American writers and their impact on our history, our culture, and our daily lives, find us online or come see us in person. The American Writers Museum is open Thursdays through Mondays from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m., only closed on Tuesdays and Wednesdays. Once again, thank you for listening, and to all you writers out there, thank you for writing.